Broadcasted live. Catch the podcast on kaya959.co.za.
And time for us to turn to Inside Your Business. This conversation is probably one that we'll pick up more than once while I'm still here hosting Kaya Biz on your on Kukuletu's behalf. A very interesting fresh load of investigation or fresh load of laundry, one should say, hashtag laundry, has been is being aired out by the Amabungani Center for Investigative Journalism, led by journalist Dierwald van Rensburg. It's about the laundry and takes into account or is giving us some insight on the shadow bankers that are powering organized crime. Now, this is not just important because crime is an issue for everybody, but because the financial and illicit flows and fraudulent flows in the country obviously destabilize business, destabilize incentives that are supposed to drive how the economy works. And that big word that got familiar with South Africans at the beginning of last year, grey listing, comes as a result of the prevalence and the pervasiveness of illicit flows of funds in this country. That is from the smallest packet of Shram Shram chips that might be sold and may hurt the health of five children in Soweto, all the way to large deals that may very well impact commodities that are being traded on various exchanges in the world. And so it's really great when Amabungani releases this kind of investigative report, the first of which came out this morning. Dierwald van Rensburg, as I say, is one of those journalists. Welcome to Kaya Biz, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Oh, no, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So one of the things that, two of the areas that you have highlighted, not only in your introductory article, but in particular in today's, are how illicit tobacco sales, as well as the gold industry or illicit Krugerrand industry, has had a massive impact. Take us into the Kruger industry scam that has, one, seems to have defrauded SARS and therefore the taxpayer, and two, exposes some concerns around due diligence at some of our most trusted institutions.
Sure thing. Well, this is part one of what will be a pretty expansive series, and we've kicked off with this old VAT scam, which is not unknown. We've reported on it before, but we have managed to learn a great deal more about the players involved in it and the kind of money involved. So, you know, long story short, Krugerrands don't have tax. You melt them, you pretend it was gold, had tax, and you export it, and you claim the tax back from SARS. And gold, in South Africa, obviously, a great deal of it circulates, and it can quickly run into the billions, which it has over many, many years. Now, there are a couple of people who you kind of dropped the ball in terms of accountability here. And chiefly, the one we look at is the Reserve Bank and its partner in the creation of Krugerrand, which is a refinery, that being of Africa, I think the Southern Hemisphere's largest gold refinery, owned by the major mining companies. So they have a monopoly. They create these Krugerrands, and they were aware that a really, really astonishing amount of these things was suddenly being bought up all over the show. And really should have. It was being bought up essentially by criminals and on a massive industrial scale. I mean, it's staggering. The amount of Krugerrands getting sold in a year was more than half the amount of gold we mine.
So this,
it's actually insane.
This is the part that really blew my hair off. There's the fact that the Kruger, particularly domestically, Krugerrand trade went from something like 6% of the gold market, I think was in your article, to over half within a couple of years.
I think it was the course of maybe 2 to 3 years.
Yes.
What we found in this article that I think is somewhat of a revelation is how a small amount of very large players drove this thing, and we kind of focused in on one about whom we managed to gather quite a lot of information, which is a man called Frank Siddiqui, who by himself is responsible for like 20% of the trade.
A very colorful character, but we'll get into that.
He's one of those. He's a pastor. He puts pictures of him with the private jet on his Instagram. He is unfortunately now in jail, fortunately or unfortunately, on a variety of charges, and there he remains. So you know, things catch up with you. He's not in jail for this. He's in jail for a whole bunch of other things.
Yes, we'll come back to that. I just want to get through if you can walk us through sort of how this this dubious trade happens and how it is that a scrupulous entity like the Reserve Bank is unfortunately involved. So one of the things that you highlighted is obviously that the Mint, the South African Mint, is the only organization that can obviously create Kruger Rands, and Rand Refinery is the only one that can trade to a wholesaler. And then this Siddiqui gentleman was involved in four of the key companies that were able to purchase them from the Reserve Bank.
Yeah, so the basic regulatory setup is that the only person who creates these things is the Mint, which is the Reserve Bank. The only people who can market them, introduce them in the market, is Rand Refinery. And the only people that can buy from Rand Refinery is a small set of authorized dealers. Now, here's where the chain of accountability really collapses. So, first of all, this guy, Siddiqui, and many others, managed to become authorized dealers after, so-called due diligence. They really shouldn't have been able to. And what they were doing should have been caught out very quickly when they started trading these insane volumes. But when we go to the Reserve Bank, there's this passing of the buck. They say, well, no, it was Rand Refinery that was vetting people. And you go to Rand Refinery and they say, well, all these guys use major banks, and the major banks are responsible for checking where money comes from. So everyone says it's the next guy's fault. And so ultimately you come back down to the banking sector, which is kind of where this series of articles will lead us.
So I was about to say... Dievald, you haven't actually disclosed as yet who those banks are, but I look forward to inviting you back to speak a little bit more about who those banks are beyond, as you mentioned in your article. It's not just the Sasfins of the world, particularly insofar as obviously we need to question a little bit more from the Reserve Bank. And thank you so much for joining us. Dievald van Rensburg is a part of is an investigative journalist with Amabungani. We are also joined this evening by Stephen Powell, head of ENS Africa's forensics practice, who might help us understand this evening, even as we don't understand which of those banks they are, how our business might be unwittingly exposed to these laundromats, and certainly how we might be able to protect ourselves. Good evening, Stephen. How are you?
Hi, very good, Rafiwe. Thanks for having me.
So I imagine you've taken a look at this article by Dievald and his colleagues. What is the best way, from your forensic experience, for one to sort of keep an eye out for potential laundry activity?
I think it's very important for businesses always out there to be doing due diligence on business partners, new customers, to understand the profile of who they are dealing with, and then to run checks to make sure that they're not inadvertently getting involved, embroiled in money laundering transactions. So you've got to look at the profile of the customer. You've got to understand what is consistent with that profile. And when there are unusual large cash payments, those are typical red flags that companies need to look out for. And a lot of times you're going to find complex structures, offshore transactions that don't make good business sense, and a lot of times the entities will want to deal with agents or third parties so that they're not directly involved themselves. And if those transactions don't make good business sense and there isn't a reasonable explanation for what the customer is trying to do, then I think companies need to be aware there are onerous reporting obligations in terms of FICA. And with South Africa having been grey listed, the anti-money laundering controls and the requirements to identify who is the ultimate beneficial owner of the entity you're dealing with is so important to feel with.
One of the concerns that I have here is, of course, KYC, Know Your Client, is usually the due diligence one goes for first and foremost. And then, of course, as you say, these higher hurdles of due diligence and obligatory reporting. But reading Dievald's story, which I think is critical, even the Reserve Bank, in dealing with what turned out to be potentially nefarious Krugerrand dealers has found that they say their due diligence was fully sort of taken care of, but an increase in Krugerrand sales from 6% to over 50% of gold sales in the domestic market was kind of a surprise to them. But, you know, what happens when you report and you've, let's say, as we always say, tick the box, and nothing is really sort of done?
I think the difficulty, you know, when people say what happens if you report and nothing is done, the SIC legislation does require us to report suspicious transactions, and there are accountable institutions like estate agents, even lawyers, and many other financial services entities that have onerous reporting obligations. And when they report to the FIC has got data analysts who will analyze the information, and they will identify if there is wrongdoing or illicit activity taking place. And then what the FIC does with that information is it provides the information to the appropriate regulator to investigate and take further. And that could be SARS, it could be the DPCI, it could be the Asset Forfeiture Unit. Whichever regulator is impacted by the activity will then be provided with not only the report, but also the underlying analysis, which will allow the investigation into the illicit activity. And one of the difficulties we face in South Africa is that our anti-money laundering controls have been found wanting by the Financial Action Task Force. Exactly. And so we've had a radical overhaul of the legislation, and the introduction of ultimate beneficial ownership information. You know, there is a register now being kept by the CIPC, and when entities engage with individuals who are all businesses that are reluctant to disclose who the ultimate beneficiaries are, or if they go into a myriad of transactions and structures to conceal who that ultimate beneficial owner is, you know, then we need to be very nervous. But the stuff does happen in very sort of tangible ways. You know, what happens with money laundering is a lot of the motor vehicle dealers get embroiled in money laundering, and some of it inadvertently and some of it very deliberately.
What, selling cars for cash?
Selling cars for cash. People, the drug dealers, the fraudsters go in and they buy a brand new 4x4 for 2 million rand.
Right.
They drive it around for a month or two, and then they take it back to the same dealer and they sell it for half the amount they paid that they bought the vehicle for. But they've now got clean cash, and they've effectively laundered the proceeds of crime.
And this is the kind of thing you want to protect your business against. Stephen, just to be clear, you know, this is, as you say, some of it is obviously very blatant and some of it is kind of inadvertent that you might get caught in this. For the listeners' sake, can you just give us a sense of the scale of laundering in this country?
Yes, so with money laundering, there are three stages that take place. And the first one is what we call placement, when the proceeds of crime, illegally obtained or illicit funds, are placed into the bona fide legitimate financial system. And usually this is done through buying legitimate assets like houses, properties, or motor vehicles. And I've done a lot of work for the Asset Forfeiture Unit, where we've gone and I've acted as a curator, seizing assets from drug dealers. And when we look at what they've actually done, very often they buy a huge portfolio of properties with the drug money, and then they rent the properties out, and in doing that, they then secure a clean income, because the funds that they get from the rental of these properties bought with the proceeds of crime is then cleaned. The next thing that happens is layering, where the illegally obtained money is disposed of to conceal the origin and to make it look legitimate. And a lot of companies or individuals create fake companies in offshore tax havens. We call these shell companies. A lot of the times, the criminals, the drug dealers, the fraudsters use what we call money mules. And money mules is something the public should be aware of as well, because a money mule is typically a pensioner or a student who is short of funds. And the crooks will go to that individual and say, I need some help. I've been blacklisted by the credit bureaus. I can't operate a bank account. Allow us to use your account. I've got a payment that's going to come in for 200,000. And if you allow.
I want to hear much more about Money Meals on its own, but I do have to let you go.
Of course.
I know you've got other commitments. Thank you so much for your insight and such deep knowledge as well. Stephen Powell giving us that very essential insight into money laundering. If you want to hear more about Money Meals, because I think any single one of us could be tricked into being one. We've all heard about these scams where an email comes into your account saying, hi, in the old days, again, I'm a bit older than most, but in the old days it was, I'm a prince, my father used to work for Sani Abacha, and I've just inherited $500 million, and if you allow me to put that $500 million in your account, you can keep $100,000. One doesn't want to end up being a money meal, and just to keep you on your tenterhooks, we heard about placement, layering, and hopefully Stephen can tell us the third stage of money laundering so you can protect yourself and your business from potential illicit funds.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.